This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
All right, I think it's just an addition to the things which government is not dealing with. Bread is an everyday commodity, and I think it should be easily accessible and cheap.
That's Mandela Nkubi, a Zimbabwean citizen unhappy about the increase in bread prices. Details coming up. Also, Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for a pair of deadly attacks that killed at least 9 people. And the World Health Organization is expressing cautious optimism that it is making headway in controlling the spread of the deadly Ebola virus in the DRC. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this morning, Zimbabweans woke up to read about a major price hike for bread, which is a staple food. That follows a fuel price increase 3 weeks ago that set off 3 days of protests. The Zimbabwean government is grappling to manage a country beset by strikes, precipitated by struggling economy. VOA correspondent Adi Gondo gives us more on the story.
The price of bread has jumped by about 70%, the fourth increase in the last year. A loaf that was selling at $1.40 now goes for between $2.10 to $2.50 in a move that citizens are greeting with chagrin. It's the biggest increase since 2009 and the first of the new year. Last November, the government held lengthy negotiations with the National Bakers Association of Zimbabwe, NBAZ, the umbrella body representing the interests of local bakers. They had proposed to push the price of bread to $2.20, but government vetoed the proposal at the time, demanding to know what could be done to keep the price at levels affordable by the ordinary citizen. Economic analyst Reginald Shoko speaks on the issue.
I think bread was going to increase, just as a follow-up to the increase of fuel, and also the fact that there has been a surge in terms of demand of bread. If you have realized in the past week, bread had no stable price, especially in the items in the suburb. It was now like the highest bidder takes it all. The price of bread could go and sell as $4, as high as $4. So it's just responding to the effect of the artificial high demand caused by the closure of shops and also the increase in petrol that has led to higher demand, which is artificial in nature, because it's not supported by anything. Remember, the wheat flour prices have not gone up. So it's the issue of petrol.
Observers say the reason behind the bread shortages could also be down to the close of shops which used to retail the bread and the knock-on effect that increases demand and therefore the prices. Alice Moyo is a 40-year-old mother of 6 children who feels the bitter taste of the bread increases.
Bread increase is affecting us very hard because as for me, I've got 6 children at home. I can't afford, I'm supposed to buy 3 loaves. So as for now, I can't. Even one, it can't. $2.50 from $1.50. It just came from a dollar. Just a few months, it's $1.50. Another month, is now $2.50. So it's very hard. We'll go back home to rural areas, I think, very soon.
Young people in Zimbabwe feel a sense of despair with government's inability to turn the economy around. Mandla Ncube expresses his frustration.
All right, I think it's just an addition to the things which government is not dealing with, which should be dealt with. You know, bread is an everyday commodity, and I think it should be easily accessible and cheap. So they should do something about it. That's too expensive. Actually, a dollar was already too expensive. So at $2.50, it's extreme. It means a lot of people are going to cut on bread and find an alternative, which is not right. They are not governing anything, actually. They're just there.
The National Bakers Association and the relevant ministry could not be reached in time for comment. The government has in the past shifted the blame to retailers, alleging that they are taking advantage of the situation to profiteer. The prices of basic commodities have been going up due to the country's currency crisis. The increase in fuel prices by about 150% on January 12th worsened the situation as retailers have noted the higher costs of business. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
While some activists in Zimbabwe are in detention and others are in hiding following last week's protests, a 25-year-old singer concerned about his pregnant wife condemned security forces. Columbus Mavunga reports for VOA.
That is Obey Makamure, better known as Toke Vibes by his legion of followers. He is singing his latest offering condemning last week's brutality of protesters by Zimbabwe security forces. The protests were triggered by a more than 150% fuel hike announced by President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Makamure says he thought up the latest song after his pregnant wife, Donant, called him, saying she could not breathe properly because of tear gas released by security forces to control protesters.
But she's pregnant. We
have been together for a long time now, about 5 years. She has been having problems of miscarriages, so I was hoping this fourth one, I'll be able to hold my baby. Then I heard she's now in tear gas. So I realized whether I like it or not, I'm involved. We do not have to be ignorant about other people's lives. I cannot be that person. My music is about people. It is not about me. If my life is for my own security, then it's not worth it, says Makamure. He says since he released the song, friends and relatives have been calling, fearing for his safety. He maintains he sings about social life, not politics, even in his latest song.
I'm not into politics. I'm for the people, you know. The army is for, it's our security, and the police, it's our security. So anytime we feel like they are abusing our rights, we should be able to say no. Even if we die for saying no, it's better than just being like a slave, you know.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa promised to roll heads in the security forces because of his brutality during the three-day protest over a 150% fuel hike. The government-appointed Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission says at least 8 people died from excessive force by the army and police that used live ammunition during the protests. Commission member Sheila Matindike says security forces also instigated torture.
It is acknowledged that property, including a police station, police vehicles, and shops, were destroyed and vandalized or looted. This, however, did not justify torture of citizens by the security forces, as the right to freedom from torture is one right that cannot be derogated from under any circumstances.
While Zimbabweans wait for the government to deal with those lost rights, musician Toke Vibes has a few words for the Zimbabwean army.
We need peace, love, and unity. Make sure all of those who are suffering, they are safe. Because those who are rich, they can protect themselves. But we, the poor, the disadvantaged ones, we need your help. Protect us.
Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for a pair of deadly attacks today in Somalia, including a car bomb in downtown Mogadishu that killed at least 9 people and wounded 7 others. Witnesses say the car was parked near one of the city's biggest shopping centers, the Mogadishu Mall, in the oldest district of Hamarawin. Al-Shabaab said the target was a meeting between regional and security officials at the nearby Mogadishu governor's headquarters. Meanwhile, the manager of P&O Port Operators in the port town of Bosaso was fatally shot as he walked to work. He was identified as Paul Anthony Formosa of Malta. 3 others were injured and the shooter was wounded and apprehended. P&O is a subsidiary of United Arab Emirates Dubai Port World and has a 30-year concession to manage Bososa Port. 6 months after the outbreak of Ebola was declared in the Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu province, the World Health Organization is expressing cautious optimism that it is making headway in controlling the spread of the deadly virus. Latest figures reported by the WHO put the number of cases of Ebola at 774, including 481 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak in Congo is far from over, and this is no time for complacency. But it says strategies being employed have been successful in controlling the outbreak in some affected areas, such as Mangina, Beni, Komanda, and Oichi. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says progress in containing the spread of the virus is due to a number of public health measures. They include the training of health workers on infection prevention and control, closer engagement with communities, case investigation, and contact tracing. She says the use of a vaccine and promising new drugs has been a boon to these efforts.
I feel optimistic. I'm very clear that we need to continue this work. We need to make sure that in the places where we've made progress, we build on this progress and we don't go backwards. And we are being very, very conscious of the fact that we need to invest to improve the preparedness in both in the DRC areas that are at highest at risk and most importantly in the surrounding countries that are at risk.
Moeti tells VOA the risk of the virus spreading to countries like Uganda, Rwanda, and South Sudan is very high because of the heavy cross-border traffic among them and affected areas in the DRC. She says surveillance and preparedness activities have been enhanced on both sides of the border. She says there is extensive monitoring at border crossings and improvements have been made in screening people for the virus. She adds 2,600 healthcare workers in Uganda have been vaccinated to protect them from the Ebola virus. She says a similar vaccination campaign began in South Sudan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Eighteen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. In France, the central government is trying to get a better count of the number of unaccompanied minors who have migrated to the country in the past few years. But its new proposal for tracking young migrants, which goes into effect in April, has gotten pushback from some city and district governments. Journalist Catherine Field in Paris has closely followed the issue of migration in Europe, and she spoke with VOA's Kate Pond-Dawson on this development.
What they're asking the local governments to do, also very much at the local level, town halls, regional parliaments, they're asking their officials there to register, and that means with photograph and fingerprints, each unaccompanied minor that comes into their area that is asking for help. Now, this information would be used to streamline any possible application for asylum that particular unaccompanied migrant would have, and it would also give the French state a way to understand how many and from which country these unaccompanied minors are coming from.
What is the motivation for this new system?
The real crux of it is that there has been an increase in the number of unaccompanied migrants coming into France. And unaccompanied minors means those aged under 18 who do not have French citizenship and have no legal representation. So when you look back at the figures, you see in 2016, some 14,000 unaccompanied minors came into France, but only 474 had their applications to be able to stay and get protection approved. That number, of course, has been going up. 2018, there was 1,084. So the French government feels that it's got to somehow get on top of this. It's got to get a grip on how many are coming into France, where they're coming from. Are they just, say, for example, unaccompanied minors who are coming from Morocco, who are jumping, if you like, at the last minute onto some of these migrant boats that come across the Mediterranean? Are they part of the people traffickers? Are they paying the people traffickers at the last minute to get on their boat? Or are they just unaccompanied minors from various countries such as the DRC, Sudan, Guinea, whose families are sending them to Europe in the hope that they will, A, get a better life, but B, more importantly, get accepted here, get a job, and be able to send remittances back to their families.
So what has the reaction been to this policy?
The reaction has been pretty much across the board, let's wait and see, perhaps we need it, except in some areas, particularly here in Paris, which has seen large numbers of unaccompanied migrants on its streets, camping in its streets. The mayor of Paris in particular has said that she will not allow this to be brought in as a system here in Paris. In Paris and in an area to the north of Paris, Seine-Saint-Denis, both those mayors have said no, they are not going to take part in this. They say pretty clearly it is the government's job to register minors. It is the government's job to actually look after them. The actual, on the ground, the town hall is there to give them protection, not to do anything else. So the problem is, as well, that the mayor of Paris is saying, is there's no more legislation about what happens to this data. Is it going to be fed into a data system that's a Europe-wide data system? Is it going to be just for the French government? There's no protection of the of their individual identities. So the mayor of Paris is saying, listen, this isn't also, at the end of the day, going to solve the problem. And look somewhere else, look at helping them, and not just setting up new systems that are going to take a lot of money. And even though the state has already said they will put 50 officials in charge of keeping track of these new dossiers, they're saying that money can be better spent elsewhere.
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Last year, more than 70,000 Americans fatally overdosed from narcotics such as heroin, oxycodone, and other opioid drugs. Indeed, President Donald Trump has declared the opioid crisis a national public health emergency. However, conventional approaches to curing addiction offer mixed results. Enter Iboga, a psychotropic plant sacred to Africa's Bwiti people. Advocates say Ibogaine, Iboga's active ingredient, minimizes or eliminates withdrawal symptoms, offers addicts life-changing psychological insights, and reduces drug craving over the long term. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Why do opioid addicts have such a hard time quitting? One reason is because the physical effects of abrupt withdrawal can seem far worse than staying hooked. However, Ibogaine seems to block those effects, says Thomas Kingsley Brown of the University of California in San Diego. Brown conducted a small observational study of clinical Ibogaine treatment in Mexico, one of only 8 nations where Ibogaine is either legal or unregulated. In an article he co-wrote for the American Journal of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, he says 23% of the subjects were still opioid-free after 1 year, and other studies report a 50% success rate.
Our study also showed that people, when they have the Ibogaine treatment, they are able to establish much better relationships with their family members and their close friends and their spouses over the long term.
Conventional addiction treatments often rely on addictive replacement drugs, such as methadone and buprenorphine. Some addicts try to taper off their use or stop cold, an approach that studies suggest produce a scant 10 to 20% success rate. The problem, Ibogaine advocates say, is that neither method addresses the underlying psychological reasons why people use addictive drugs and why they tend to relapse after they quit. But Ibogaine treatments are different. Within an hour of ingesting a dose of Ibogaine, patients enter a dreamlike psychedelic state where they can revisit the emotional wounds that led to their drug use and become aware of its impact on themselves and others. That's what made all the difference for Dimitri Mugyanis of New York.
It saved a wretch like me.
In 2002, Mugyanis was 40 and a longtime heroin, cocaine, and alcohol addict living in his parents' basement and contemplating suicide. As a last resort, he went to an ibogaine clinic in the Netherlands. Within an hour of taking the ibogaine capsule, his withdrawal symptoms subsided and a three-day inner voyage began.
I was able to deal with my physical and sexual abuse as a child. I was able to deal and forgive my father for some of his violent behavior. I was able to see ancestral patterns, visit ancestors, see my dead wife who died while using drugs and was pregnant and I had a lot of guilt for. I was able to relieve myself of the guilt and also take responsibility for what I had done. It was a very difficult experience, but you come out of it and you realize, yeah, I did that, but I can change and I can live my life in a different way. It actually showed me that I could feel happy, joyous, and free.
Today, Mugyanis is still opioid-free and leads ibogaine retreats in Mexico. Deborah Mash, a neuropharmacologist at the University of Miami and a leading expert on the drug, touts another important feature. Ibogaine leaves the body within a day, but before it does, some metabolizes into noribogaine, which reduces the psychological craving and depression that often trigger relapse.
I've been studying ibogaine since the early 1990s, and I have seen it save lives. And I get phone calls from people who are clean and sober for over 10 years. One or two treatments have helped them. It's not a cure, but it is a powerful first step on the road to recovery.
Ibogaine treatment does carry risks. There have been reports of death from adverse reactions, mostly due to unsupervised use, undiagnosed heart problems, or the mixture of ibogaine with other drugs. But Mash says that rigorous pre-screening and close medical supervision diminish those risks. Still, more FDA-approved research and clinical trials are needed. If ibogaine's promise is borne out, Mash is hopeful that the FDA will fast-track the drug to market and make it easily available to the millions who need it. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the West perpetually talks about its democratic values, self-determination, and freedoms. Can these concepts become realities in Africa? Discussing freedom of expression on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.